The beef industry has been accused of being a major contributor to greenhouse gas emissions and global warming by elected officials in Washington, celebrities in Hollywood, major media outlets, as well as environmental and animal activist groups. The storyline goes that if we reduce or eliminate beef production, we could reduce, if not eliminate, global warming and climate change. Welcome to this edition of the Beef Roundtable. I'm Dr. Ron Lemonager, Beef Extension Specialist at Purdue University, West Lafayette, Indiana.
And I'm Bert Rutherford, Senior Editor of Beef Magazine. I'm in Wheat Ridge, Colorado.
Joining us today to talk about the beef industry's impact on the environment and long-term sustainability, we have Dr. Mitt Lohner, Professor and Air Quality Extension Specialist in the Department of Animal Science at the University of California, Davis, and Dr. Sarah Place, who is just finishing her role as Senior Director of Sustainable Beef Production with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association and moving to Elanco as their Technical Consultant in Sustainability. The term sustainability is thrown around a lot. Sarah, you're a sustainability expert. Maybe we need to define the term sustainability before we start this discussion.
Yeah, absolutely. So it is something that I think we always reference that people will have different definitions for when we talk about sustainability, but there's large agreement that it comes down to the fact that you have to balance economic viability, environmental stewardship, and social responsibility. And it's about a long-term focus, right? It's about thinking about multiple generations in the future. So hopefully as producers hear that, they think, you know, hey, that's kind of a lot of what I already focused on, right? First and foremost, you have to be economically viable and can't emphasize that enough, right? That's the key for sustainability is you got to be able to make green to be green, if you will. And as we'll go through the rest of this discussion, I'm sure we'll emphasize a lot of the environmental issues. But again, I think that's really important that this idea of, you know, stewarding your natural resources, of doing right by future generations, doing right by your community, that's something that a lot of our producers are already focused on. They just may not use the word sustainability to talk about it.
Yeah, Frank, let's follow up on that a little bit. You know, Sarah used the word stewardship several times, and I know you have said that sustainability is just nothing more than stewardship. And it's nothing that we should shy away from or be afraid of. Is that right?
Well, in my opinion, sustainability should be owned by people in animal agriculture because that's what they routinely do. Focus on stewardship of the land. Focus on stewardship of your animals, whether it's cattle or other species. You know, being a good steward of your community, of your family, of your workers, and so on. I mean, the term stewardship has always been out there. People call it sustainability today, but I don't think that this is anything to shy away from, but it's something to be proud of and endorse.
Well, thank you for that. I think that's important. Let's now drill down a little bit. We talk a lot about greenhouse gases relative to sustainability, particularly those folks who don't like beef production. Frank, what do we know about greenhouse gases and how they affect us and the environment?
So there are a number of gases called greenhouse gases. What they do is they absorb heat from the sun, and they also pretty much form a blanket over our atmosphere. So imagine sunlight coming in, radiant heat from the sun coming into the Earth's atmosphere. Normally, that heat would be reflected back into space. That radiation would go back into space. If they were in the so-called greenhouse gases, they pretty much form a blanket and retain the heat from the sun in our atmosphere. And that's a very important function that these greenhouse gases have. And without their existence, we couldn't live on this planet. It would be way too cold. The question is, how much is too much? And currently, it seems like we have too much of these greenhouse gases. And then the next question arises, what are the contributing sources of greenhouse gases? Who and what produces them? How is human activity responsible for it? And here there is a political war going on that oftentimes is not really supported by science.
Let me follow up with that. So with that basic understanding of what greenhouse gases are, how does animal production in the U.S. Contribute to that? Are we bad? Are there other segments of society that contribute?
So there are three main greenhouse gases. One is called CO2, carbon dioxide. We're exhaling it right now. You emit it when you drive a car. Anytime we burn fossil fuels, we produce the CO2. Then there's methane, and this is really the big deal for animal agriculture, particularly ruminant animals, because methane is belched out. A process called enteric fermentation generates this methane, meaning microbes in the rumen of our animals produce methane, and it's then coming out the front end. And then there's also methane coming from the manure, animal manure. So combined methane from enteric and manure sources are the big deal in agriculture. The third one is nitrous oxide. Nitrous oxide is a very potent greenhouse gas. It's mainly associated with fertilizing of soil with either chemical fertilizers or manure. Once you put nitrogen into the soil, it can be converted into nitrous oxide, and that goes into the atmosphere. So what are the different sources of greenhouse gases in a country like the United States? According to the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, all of those sources emitting fossil fuel-related emissions, and that's emissions from oil, coal, and gas, those different sources or these different sectors of society emit a total of around 80%, 80. So what are these sectors? It's transportation, it's power production and use, and it's certain industries such as the cement industry. And these three combined emit approximately 80%. Animal agriculture in its totality, all species, beef, dairy, swine, sheep, and so on, all of animal agriculture combined emits 3.9% of all greenhouse gases. All agriculture, so that's not animal and plant agriculture combined, 9%. So again, fossil fuel consuming and producing industries emit about 80%, animal agriculture 3.9%. You're interested in beef only, using the same methodology as the previous ones for fossil fuels and agriculture in total. If you're interested in beef only, it's about 2% of the total. That's direct emissions, what we call direct emissions. You look at the entire life cycle, everything related to beef production from cradle to grave, it's a little over 3%. So the notion that beef production, beef consumption is a major driver is not accurate, but beef certainly is a contributor. But it's a totally different ballgame compared to some of the fossil fuel-related activities we in society are engaged in.
Let me follow up with that, Frank. You know, FAO with the United Nations kind of talked about that beef production was about 18%, as I remember the number, greenhouse gas. So where did they come up with an 18% or something in that neighborhood?
So there's a lot of confusion about that. The original report that you're referring to is called Livestock's Long Shadow, and that Livestock's Long Shadow assigned 18% of greenhouse gases to global livestock, not beef, but global livestock, all livestock species combined. I was among those who critiqued that report, and they responded positively to my criticism and revisited the whole question of how much and how does livestock compare to other sectors globally? So I revisited it and came up with a new number. 14.5% is the global contribution of all livestock and poultry species. 14.5% global, and that includes all livestock and poultry species. Their earlier notion that livestock emits more greenhouse gases than the entire global transportation system, which was also part of Livestock's Long Shadow, was retracted. As part of my criticism of their report. And the reason why it was retracted was because they used different methodologies for assigning the impact of livestock on greenhouse gases versus those from transportation. For livestock, they looked at so-called life cycle of livestock-related emissions, and it gets complicated now. I apologize. But for transportation, they only looked at direct emissions, meaning for livestock, they looked at everything from soils to plants, making feeds to animals eating it, and belching and the manure, and then transporting goods to a processing plant, all the way to us eating it. It's called a life cycle assessment, where you look at everything from cradle to grave. And that's what they did for livestock. But for transportation, they didn't use a life cycle approach, but they only focused on tailpipe emissions, not on the production of cars and trucks and trains and planes and airports and railway and so on, but only emissions coming out of the tailpipes of vehicles. So they compared apples to oranges and later retracted that comparison.
Sarah, let me follow up a little on that with, you know, the livestock's long shadow created a tremendous medium event. And so if you listen to the popular media and all the hype surrounding, you know, this whole discussion, you know, it may be that consumers start feeling guilty about eating meat. But what if we eliminated meat from our diet? Is that going to help? What does that mean?
Yeah. So I think Frank kind of touched on what the big picture is in the U.S., right? If we think about that comparison you just made about direct and life cycle emissions, you know, that 3.94% of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions that come from livestock are the direct emissions that really come from those animals and their manure, right? So even if we were just to think about it from that perspective, that would be the maximum that we could reduce, right, if we truly eliminated all those animals. But taking it one step further, there was actually a study that came out a couple of years ago published in the Proceedings of the National Academies of Sciences. Looked at this from a U.S. perspective, right, and looked at what is the maximum amount of greenhouse gas emission reduction that can come from dietary change within the United States. So what these two scientists looked at was that scenario of, like, what if we all went vegan, right? Every human, every cat and dog in America is now eating a vegan diet, right? What would that actually do to greenhouse gas emissions? They found it would reduce them in the U.S. by about 2.6 percentage points. So that's less than a 0.5% globally of total greenhouse gas emissions. And we would create a food supply where we'd have nutrient deficiencies, right? We wouldn't have any vitamin B12 in our food supply if we had no animal source foods, because that's the only source of vitamin B12 in our food supply, right? So the trade-off there is we'd have slightly fewer greenhouse gas emissions and a nutrient supply that wouldn't nourish everybody, right? So it's not a very good trade-off. Critiques of that study usually come down to saying, well, that's not really looking at all the consequences that would happen, but ultimately it's kind of an upper bound, if you will, right, a threshold of it's really hard to imagine how reducing or changing our diets would reduce greenhouse gas emissions more than that, right? It's hard to reduce it more than they're actually emitting, right, in terms of those livestock. So I think the bottom line is you can't eat your way out of climate change, right, especially not in the United States. As Frank mentioned earlier, the bulk of our emissions are coming from burning fossil fuels. So whether you're eating, you know, a vegan diet or eating a ribeye steak every day, it just really doesn't amount to much of anything, right? And I think, unfortunately, as you referenced, Bert, I mean, people are hearing this and they're concerned and they feel kind of guilty, right, about some people do feel guilty about eating meat or eating animal source foods. We've kind of created this perception gap between perception and reality of how much our diets are affecting this issue.
Well, now, just to follow up with that, and you know, the New Yorker published an article back a little while ago that suggested that eating 4 pounds of beef contributed as much greenhouse gas as a transatlantic flight from New York City to London. You know, and so what you've just said is that the diet really doesn't make any difference. So let's touch on that, because I think our consumers are getting that message. And, you know, if we don't provide the science behind the rebuttal to that, you know, that's what people are going to think about. Any comments on that?
Well, I was responsive to this article because it really got to me. I am no longer in a position where I could just lean back and say, well, you know, this is just another story out there that's not plausible, but what can I do? And so I decided to start a center here at UC Davis, the CLEAR Center, and we're actually working on not just responding to reports like that, but also providing information to important media outlets. With the New Yorker, stated that 2 pounds of beef equals a transatlantic flight, I wrote a blog. That blog was then picked up by the Wall Street Journal and by Bloomberg, and the New Yorker asked me for a letter to the editor, which I provided. Because this comparison of 4 pounds equals 1 transatlantic flight is not just incorrect, it's dangerous. And the reason why it's dangerous is because it makes people believe that it's our food choices that are the all-encompassing impact that we have as people on climate. And that is simply not the case. Our food choices certainly have an impact, there's no doubt about that. But to compare consumption of a few pounds of meat to a transatlantic flight is ridiculous. And I knew where I came from, and I talked to authors of people who wrote it and provided in-depth commentary, and it's very clear that there are different parties that speak past each other, and we have a lot of work to do, for sure.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, the other problem with all of this is that, you know, if we eliminate beef from the diet, and Frank, I know I've heard you talk about this before, if we eliminate beef from the diet, we've got a lot of acres that are not row croppable, you know, globally. And so, you know, people think that if we would divert land use from grazing to either row crops, corn, soybeans, fruits, vegetables, and those kinds of things. So put that into perspective. And Sarah, add to that as well.
Well, let me just grab a sheet of paper here, okay? Imagine this sheet of paper here being the surface of the earth. That's the entire surface of the earth. Now I take this sheet of paper and I fold it twice. And now this sheet of paper, this quarter of the sheet of paper, represents all land in the world. The rest is water and ice. This is all land. The rest is water and ice. Now, this here is my business card. Imagine the size of my business card being the surface of the earth that's agricultural land, okay, agricultural land. So this is how little agricultural land we have in the world. If I now take my business card and I fold it into one piece that's two-thirds and the other piece that's one-third, I rip my business card into pieces, then the total card, again, is all agricultural land. The larger of the two pieces, the two-thirds, is what's called marginal land. This is land, by and large, that either doesn't have sufficient soil quality or enough water to grow crops. What do we do with that land currently? We use it for ruminant livestock, and why do we do this? Because this is where non-human edible feed grows, namely cellulose-rich material. So because of ruminant animals, we can make use of two-thirds of all agricultural land that otherwise would not be usable for food production, by and large. The remaining one-third of my business card is what's called arable land, and that's the only land we have in the world really to grow crops for human and animal feed and food production. And so I think it is very important for us to say not just do ruminant animals or are ruminant animals able to recycle certain non-human edible feeds such as cotton seeds and almond oils and stillers grains and so on, but they are able to upcycle non-human edible feeds such as cellulose containing grasses, upcycle them into highly nutritious, bioavailable and digestible food. And so this is a beautiful thing, and I think that we are not telling that story enough. It's a beautiful thing because this is a solar-powered system of taking something that's non-human edible into something that's highly digestible, highly metabolizable by humans.
Sarah, looking at the concepts of sustainability / stewardship, how are U.S. beef producers doing? Are we reducing greenhouse gases? Are we becoming more sustainable based on the definition that we started with?
Yeah, so I think that's important to kind of come back to that, and that's good to highlight is we've already talked about how these statistics can be a little bit manipulated, right? If we talk about global versus U.S., and to your point, things aren't static, right? Things change over time. So Most people that are listening to this are probably pretty highly aware of the trends that are taking place in terms of the number of cattle in the U.S. has actually declined, total cattle from the mid-70s to today. And yet we're producing more beef, right? So even in the last 20 years, if you just look at EPA data, we've lowered the total amount of actual greenhouse gas emissions that are coming from animal agriculture, coming from specifically from beef cattle production, and we're producing more beef. So based on that criteria, there's been a lot of progress made, and that's almost been unintentional, if you will, just driven by the fact that our producers are always focused on improving their efficiencies, right, in terms of producing more with less. So that's been a key thing. And then if we think about some of those land aspects that Frank was just talking about, I think that's what's important, too, is to broaden this discussion out, is that cattle producers provide more than just food, right? They do provide food, but they also provide societal benefits when it comes to just managing a landscape and using ruminant animals to preserve open space, preserve grassland habitats, you know, and all the benefits that come with that of keeping carbon in the ground, keeping water cycles working properly, all those things that go with actual beef production, in addition to taking all the byproducts from other industries, right? And I think that's something that we've seen over time change as well in the U.S. beef industry, is the percent of byproducts, especially in finishing cattle diets, has increased. And so some of that upcycling value and that protein contribution of the U.S. beef industry has actually improved in terms of we generate far more protein for the human food supply than exists without cattle. So when we talk about a sustainability story and thinking about, you know, we're doing all this effort to feed people in large part, right? We're doing a really good job at improving that over time.
You know, producing 18% of global beef with 8% of the global beef herd here in the United States. That true, Sarah?
Yes. So that's important to understand too, right? Again, almost a fifth of all the beef in the world is produced in the United States. And yet we have far lower percents of the total global cattle herd, right? And so that's true with beef and dairy. That's true across animal agriculture, right? Is that we are able to have more productive animals, and that means fewer natural resources, fewer potential negative environmental impacts to actually nourish everybody. And so that's, again, it doesn't mean things are perfect and we can't improve further, or can't, again, emphasize some of those economic viability aspects of our producers. But from that standpoint, we're doing a very good job.
No, one other comment on that is that, and it kind of fits into this, is that when we put together the new Beef NRC publication, about 80% on a life cycle basis, about 80% of what cattle eat during their life cycle is roughages or forages, that part that Frank mentioned just a little bit ago in terms of that non-arable land. About 10%, just a little bit over 10% is kind of the byproducts, okay, in the life cycle. And then less than 10% is cereal grains that potentially could be moved into the human food chain. But a lot of times those are off-spec grains that are used for, that can't be used in wheat milling, for example, to make flour, or, you know, corn to make cornflakes or whatever it is. So that kind of adds to that discussion just a little bit as well. One other question that I want to ask is, how does food waste, okay, both on a global scale and on a U.S. scale, how does that impact this whole idea of greenhouse gas and environmental impact?
Well, food waste is a huge issue. It's actually not just food waste, it's also food loss. And so the category of food waste and food loss is a major topic, not just nationally, but also internationally. Let me give you a few numbers here. In the United States, the USDA believes that we are wasting around 40% of the food that's produced here. 40%. And obviously an enormous number. The FAO says that North America has on average 40% food waste. The most perishable foods are fruits and vegetables, wasted by over 50%. Meats and milk are wasted 10 to 20% in North America. What blows my mind is that even in food insecure regions of the world, let's say African countries, food losses, food waste also amounts to approximately 40%. But they're more on the field. People cannot harvest on time or transport the products off the fields to the markets preserve them, refrigerate them, and so on. So there, the food loss, food waste occurs more early on in the food supply chain, whereas here in the U.S. and in other developed countries, the food loss, food waste really occurs more at the consumer level. So 40% globally is really unacceptable, and I think regardless of what your individual food preferences are and what you believe to be right or wrong, I think everybody should agree upon that this is unacceptable that we as humankind waste that much food.
And I would just say, you know, this is where animal agriculture comes into play too, right? So a lot of times things that could be considered waste get fed back to livestock, right? Whether it's pigs and chickens or ruminants, right? And to that point of food losses or things left in the field, you know, that's, again, the beauty of having livestock. You know, they're mobile units that are able to clean up some of that waste, right, and create value out of it, that whole upgrading and upcycling process yet again. So I think when we talk about food waste or we talk about any of these issues is, again, sometimes it's framed as either or, right, as, you know, it's plant agriculture, animal agriculture, and kind of pointing fingers at each other rather than looking at the whole system and realizing, you know, just like natural ecosystems need plants and animals and soil and microbes working together, so does an agriculture, right? And that's very basic. It's kind of a no-brainer to a lot of people in agriculture, but it really does need to be communicated in that way. I think we have, again, too much of this black and white absolutist view of things, and we need to reemphasize to people that, especially when it comes to byproducts, you know, that's the beauty of livestock. For every 100 pounds of human food that comes from crops globally, about 37 pounds of byproducts get generated. And so, you know, that even our so-called alternative proteins, you know, if you look at their ingredient list, they're generating byproducts too that no doubt get fed to livestock, right? So none of this stuff is as neat and tidy as some would like to put it in their in boxes like that.
What you're really saying is that if we didn't have livestock, you know, most of that waste would probably go into a landfill and create more greenhouse gas emissions than our current, right?
Yeah, there's been some analysis of that. You know, some folks at Cornell looked at that of just, you know, what's the carbon cost of feeding byproducts to dairy cows versus throwing it in a landfill or incinerating it, right? And hopefully that makes sense. You know, that was referenced earlier, but that's all beef, milk, eggs, all these products are. They're just carbon capture products, right? So the more we can run it through a system, cycle it through a system, and capture it in the actual animal products and turn it into human usable stuff, the better. So, you know, that's if something's going to decompose either way, you might as well run it through livestock first, right?
Sarah and Frank, you know, this has been, the conversation here has been really enlightening. You know, Frank mentioned that, Frank, you mentioned that you came to the decision that you could no longer not be a part of the consumer conversation. Taking that down to an individual beef producer level, how can an individual producer become part of that consumer conversation?
Well, in my opinion, it's very important to become part of the conversation. And I think that it's really important for people hearing or seeing this that they have to understand that they are part of this. Okay, they have to not just wait for somebody to tell their story, but they have to do it themselves. Because I believe that many consumers out there actually have a high level of trust in a farmer or in a rancher. A high level of trust. But they're just not sure that what's happening in food production is still done by farmers and ranchers. Once people are willing to talk, they'd be surprised how much people will listen. Currently, the people who do the talking are people who are generally not really growing food. They call themselves experts. Many of them have never set foot on a farm or ranch in their lives. And I know what I'm talking about because I'm dealing with them a lot. And the people who do the growing are generally the ones who say, well, you know, I'm a private person and I don't really want to talk to the media or talk to the public or talk to anyone. Well, if you don't, then don't complain that your story doesn't get told because it's your story. It is actually your legacy that we're dealing with here. And there are people who try to take it away from you. So in my opinion, you should be owning this, and you should be proud of it, and you should address questions as they come along Because if you don't, somebody else will, maybe in a much less professional way than you could. So don't be worried about not being media trained or so. And I'm not talking about you talking to NPR or CNN, but anyone out there can talk to their community, can talk to members of their church or talk to their family, their own family. I mean, we see now so many cases of people having issues within their own family where communication around food is really single-sided. And I think farmers and ranchers really need to step up big times.
Mm-hmm.
Any last comments from either one of you, the things that we missed that we need to touch on, okay, to bring this discussion to a close?
I actually do think that we have one point that we haven't talked about, and that is the issue around greenhouse gases being really different from different sources, particularly a new development in the scientific discussion around methane. Methane from ruminant animals. I would like to say a few words to that, if I may.
Yes.
So, you know, it's important also to mention that greenhouse gases are not created equal. So let's say people are quite concerned about methane from ruminant livestock, but, you know, that methane is called CH4. That's the chemical formula, CH4. That carbon in the methane actually originates in the atmosphere. It's the CO2 in the atmosphere, carbon dioxide, that plants need in addition to sunlight and water. So a plant needs CO2, sunlight, and water, and then the plant produces cellulose and other carbohydrates. So sooner or later, ruminant animal comes along and eats that plant, and with it, the carbon that originated from the atmosphere, that's now cellulose. That ruminant then eats that plant, and some of that carbon now is converted into methane. What's really important here is this methane, once it's belched out by the animal, or once it comes off as new methane, that methane stays in the atmosphere for only 10 years, about a decade. And after that decade, that methane is converted into CO2 again, atmospheric CO2. And that CO2, sooner or later, the similar amount, is going back into plants, back into animals, converted into methane, and so on. It is a so-called biogenic carbon cycle. So if you keep your livestock herds constant, and we have done that for a long time, actually we have shrunk our livestock herds, then you're not adding additional new carbon to the atmosphere. You're not adding additional new carbon to the atmosphere, you're not adding new warming. And this is really important because this so-called biogenic carbon cycle that I just described is in sharp contrast to the so-called fossil fuel-related greenhouse gases. What are those? Those are gases associated with oil, coal, and gas that were stored in the ground for a very long time. That's pure carbon that we have extracted largely over the last 70 or so years. We have taken them out of the ground, we have burned them, and by doing so, we are putting that carbon into the atmosphere. That is new additional carbon leading to new additional warming. It's in sharp contrast to the biogenic carbon cycle that we associate with animal agriculture.
Sarah, any other comments on that?
Yeah, I think what's always helpful is to kind of think about it like a bathtub analogy, right? Ultimately, what we care about in climate change is, as Frank told you in the beginning about greenhouse gas emissions, is their concentration in the atmosphere. We can kind of think about that like the water level in a bathtub. And what matters is, you know, if we think about a bathtub, we have a drain, we have water going in, right? And the situation that Frank just talked about with methane, if we have water going into the tub and coming out at the same rate, I mean, everybody understands that the water level on the tub is going to stay the same. Right. So what's taking place in the United States, as we mentioned earlier, is the total cattle herd has declined. Right. So even if those cattle maybe slightly increase the amount of methane emissions per animal because they're larger animals, they eat more, still the total amount of methane in the U.S. has gone down. Right. So we've essentially been slightly turning off the faucet, if you will, in our bathtub analogy, and the drain has remained the same. So hopefully that makes sense for people as they're listening to this, is that if we think back to what matters is that water level or the concentration of gases in the atmosphere, you know, it's really hard to point to U.S. cattle as a source of increasing methane concentrations. The situation is globally, and I want to throw that caveat out there, is that the global cattle herd has increased, and so this is comes back to that earlier part of the conversation too. What may be true globally can be different than the United States, and so we always have to be careful about what geographic region we're talking about and what time frame we're talking about.
We'd sure like to thank Dr. Sarah Place and Dr. Frank Mintloner for being our guests today for some really interesting information about this topic. Please find links to additional materials in the show notes below this video. And also, please join us again next month when our Beef Roundtable discussion will delve into the topic of current foreign trade challenges and successes.